From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Netflix is reportedly buying a movie theater. What on earth for? Then the ghosts of Roy Orbison and Maria Callas are on tour. We hear from the company that creates holograms of legendary musicians and ask about the ethical dilemmas involved.
You know, if I wanted to, I could have had Roy doing backflips and Maria Callas singing an Eminem song, but they never would do that, so we did not do that.
And an experimental staging of King Lear leaves the star of the story off stage. All that coming up on The Frame.
Podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Dogman from the director of Gomorrah is a crime thriller that tells a story of vengeance where only the strong survive. Best Actor winner at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. Opens April 12th in New York and LA.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Netflix moved further into the film business yesterday with its reported plan to purchase the historic Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, Netflix's first ever brick-and-mortar movie house. The Egyptian is owned and operated by the nonprofit American Cinematheque, and its programmers will continue screening classic movies, tributes, and retrospectives at the theater on the weekends. But what will having a Hollywood-based movie theater mean for Netflix as the streaming giant strives to be a bigger Oscar contender? Is it just a fancy place to stage premieres and parties, or the first step of a bigger plan? To take a closer look at the Netflix announcement, I called up Ann Thompson. She's editor-at-large at IndieWire, and she addressed Netflix's motivation in buying the Egyptian.
Netflix has been enhancing its awards profile and putting a lot of energy into taking over the Raleigh studios and putting on all of these dog and pony shows for the Emmys and for the Oscars. And so what's going on? They're getting points for philanthropy. They're getting, you know, brownie points inside Hollywood for doing a good thing. And then they're getting a screen, a nice, big, juicy screen and a space that they can use for all of this award stuff. It isn't necessarily about them becoming exhibitors, I would suggest.
Yeah, that seems to be something that a lot of people are conflating. Now, Netflix, and you and I were both at CinemaCon last week, was a big topic of conversation because Netflix does not follow the traditional release pattern of when movies premiere in theaters versus when they premiere on streaming services. And there's been talk about Netflix looking into and perhaps buying a theatrical exhibition chain. But the Cinematheque doesn't really solve the fundamental problem, and that is, will Netflix movies play theatrically on a national platform before they appear on the streaming service? So they still face that issue, and that issue still might be a problem with Netflix and the Academy. Is that right?
You are correct. Although, in my conversations at Netflix, I realized that the Windows impasse is not anywhere close to being resolved. And we just have two fundamentally different business models. And what the theater owners really want is for Netflix, with just a few movies a year, the big high-profile movies, they would love to play The Irishman, the new Martin Scorsese movie. But they will not book it if it's going to be on a subscription platform streaming within a few weeks. Basically, I do think that Netflix could play ball with the theaters more than they're doing now and really book their movies and really declare their box office and let their movies play and then move them off and put them on the platform, just a few of them. And that's where we're heading for the moment. That Windows impasse is firm, and they're going to have to go to independent cinemas if they want to show their movies in theaters.
No, I think you raise a really good point. I mean, movie theater owners right now want their films to play, and it's not set in stone, but generally it's around 3 months or 90 days. And that doesn't work in the Netflix model. And the National Association of Theater Owners has made the case that if you want your movie to stand apart on a streaming service, the best way to distinguish it is to have a theatrical run. You have this big Martin Scorsese film with Robert De Niro, with Al Pacino. It's called The Irishman. It cost apparently upwards of $175 million. Yes, theater owners would want to have it, but they're not going to take it if they only get it for a couple of weeks. Is it possible that Netflix can show some of its movies for more than a night at the Egyptian? Or is this really going to be just a place for premieres and events and not really a theater that would book a movie that Netflix produces for a longer period of time?
What you're raising is the question of what is the Egyptian? And the Egyptian is really not a first-run movie house. It's a repertory cinema, and they book independent stuff for a few days, or they do series, or they do film festivals. And the current programming team at the American Cinematheque is going to continue booking it on the weekends, according to my sources. So until that changes, they would need to book it for a whole week, and including the weekend. So I suspect it's just an opening of a door that they can explore further later on. But right now, they would still be booking the Landmark or something like that.
And I think the real issue going forward is whether or not Netflix has the money and will, they certainly probably have the money, to buy a theater chain. I think that is a natural evolution. There are not a lot of chains that are on the block, and certainly they cost a lot of money. Is that, you think, a potential workaround for Netflix, rather than renting theaters on a case-by-case basis, as they did with Roma, to actually try to buy a national chain, maybe not a huge one, and that way have a theatrical footprint that maybe gets them some box office numbers and maybe makes the Academy not quite as antagonistic?
What's fascinating to me is the idea that you have someone like Scott Stuber over at Netflix, who's running their original content movies. And he comes from the studios, and he knows the studios. He knows exactly how it works. And he is trying to talk to exhibitors and trying to figure out where the middle ground might be, and talk his own boss, Ted Sarandos, into some of this stuff, because he's trying to get the filmmakers. That's what it's about. It's getting Scorsese and Cuarón and people like that to bring their movies over to Netflix, when most movie directors want their movies to be in theaters. They want the bells and whistles. John Chu, you may have heard this at CinemaCon, gave a very eloquent speech about what being in movie theaters did for Crazy Rich Asians, including making movie stars out of the cast. These are real things that happen in theaters, and filmmakers know it. But Ted Sarandos had an opportunity to buy a theater chain, the Landmark theater chain, the indie chain, and he let Charles Cohen buy it. He kicked the tires, said, "This is a business I don't want to be in," and walked away.
Ann Thompson is editor-at-large at IndieWire. Ann, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It was my pleasure, John.
Coming up, Roy Orbison and Maria Callas are no longer alive, but they're back on tour thanks to a hologram. Ever since a hologram of the late Tupac Shakur appeared on stage at the Coachella Music Festival 7 years ago, people have been asking, should dead musicians get an encore on stage? My guest today is hologram entrepreneur Marty Tudor, and he certainly thinks the answer is yes. He and Brian Becker run Bass Hologram. It's a production company that specializes in reanimating musical legends, including Roy Orbison and opera singer Maria Callas. Their holograms are remarkably realistic, and they perform on stage with live musicians. Occasionally, the holograms engage in theatrics. Orbison at one point rises up from below the stage, and Callas magically suspends a deck of cards in midair. But for the most part, Bass Hologram prides itself on authentic representations culled from in-depth research and collaborations with artist friends and families. Tudor has been in the entertainment industry for a long time, both in lighting design and artist management. He spoke with me about getting into hologram production and the technical and ethical obstacles that followed.
I hearken back to my theater days and roots, because really what we're doing is putting on a theatrical show here. We are not pretending that the artist is still here or making the audience believe that the artist is still here. What does happen, which is fascinating, is when you watch it, because we use a mixture of the hologram along with live people on stage. So in the case of our Maria Callas hologram, there's 50 musicians on stage plus a live conductor. What happens is, even though you consciously know that it's not a live person you're watching. Your brain at some point just begins to accept it as being a person. I've seen this hundreds of times now, and it still happens to me. I'd like to dig into the psychology of that.
When I'm watching Maria Callas or Roy Orbison perform, is it footage from existing performances in the past, or are you creating that from scratch?
There is the possibility to take performances from the past, and there's a technique called rotoscoping where you can basically cut out a person from an existing piece of film. But we have found that you can't really do that, especially with the older artists like Maria Callas and Roy Orbison. You know, the quality of the footage is really lacking. So we wind up, in this case, with both of them, created it from scratch. And we do that exactly the same way they created the Peter Cushing character in the last Star Wars movie, or Carrie Fisher in that same movie. We use a body double who creates a performance, and then we do a lot of computer graphics work on that to make it look like the person.
You obviously are having performances where somebody may never have seen somebody like Roy Orbison perform live, but he certainly played with a lot of musicians who are still around. Have you ever had a chance to show one of your holograms to somebody who knew what it was like to be on stage with that person?
I actually have not. Unfortunately, certainly in the case of Callas, the majority of the people that were on stage with her have passed. Although when we were creating our Callas, we did very, very deep research into her, and we found a gentleman who is now in his either late 80s or early 90s. His name is Paul Huntley, and he's one of the most famous hair designers on Broadway, who actually had his fingers in Maria Callas's hair and did her hair. And so he consulted to us on that. As well as, in the case of Callas, I sought out a director, our creative director on that project is a gentleman by the name of Stephen Wadsworth. And Stephen is the head of the opera department at Juilliard, as well as a staff director at the Metropolitan Opera, and has directed operas all over the world, at La Scala, etc. And he also directed a show on Broadway called Masterclass, which is about Maria Callas. So, you know, we dig deep to find people with the knowledge and the credibility to bring these people alive, quote unquote.
We're talking with Marty Tudor about his production company, Base Hologram. When you are talking to the family or estate of an artist who is no longer with us, those conversations have to be kind of legally complicated, but also kind of morally complicated, because you're talking about somebody who is no longer alive, and you're essentially kind of reanimating them in a kind of almost divine way.
Well, morally and ethically, we are committed to giving an authentic reproduction, if you will, of the artist. And we do interface very, very intensely with the estates. In the case of Orbison, his three sons were with us and involved with us literally every step of the way. It was they who helped us decide what the show would be, what the musical lineup would be, our clothing choices, our guitar. Literally everything was as it was. You know, if I wanted to, I could have had Roy doing backflips, and I could have had Maria Callas singing an Eminem song if I wanted to, but they never would do that, so we did not do that. For us, it never really was an ethical question. To me, it becomes an ethical question when you have them do things that they never did or never would do.
I close my eyes. then I'd have to go away.
When you have the ability to create a performer, essentially, at any time period, how do you decide what part of their career, at what age you want to depict them? Because you can make a choice with Roy Orbison to go 20 or 30 years in either direction. How do you settle on the time period that you chose?
That's a really great question. We look at an artist and we look at where their zenith, if you will, was in their career. Now, in the case of Roy's a really good example because he had many ups and downs. So there was early in his career, he was enormous, and then it kind of waned, and then he came back again, and then it kind of waned, and then he came back again. And so we chose what Roy looked like around when he did the Traveling Wilburys.
In dreams, you're mine, all of the time.
And we did that because that's the Roy that most people remember and can relate to. So we try and choose a period when today's audiences still have them in their memories.
You're not just limiting your work right now to concerts. You're also working with people like Jack Horner, who is the paleontologist who consulted on the Jurassic Park movies with something called Jack Horner's World of Dinosaurs. What's the idea there? Where do you see the technology being used for an event or series of events like that?
Well, with that, that's a museum-oriented exhibit, and we are planning to have Jack be there with you and taking you through a dig and then showing you how dinosaurs evolved and what his current beliefs are about how they looked. And you will see life-size dinosaurs in 3D on stage.
There's a quote in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
To those people who say to you, and I'm not talking about the estates, who are uncomfortable with the ethics of this whole idea, even if the estate is on board, what do you say to them? What's your counter argument?
Well, I don't think that this is anything different than when you go to the movie theater and you watch a movie and someone's on screen that has passed. When you watch Some Like It Hot on your TV and Marilyn Monroe and Tony Curtis and, they're on screen, you don't think that's odd or strange. And so this is the same thing in a different format. That's all.
So much of watching a live performance is not just hearing the music or that evening's interpretation of the music, but watching the performers interact. You can't do that, really, when you have somebody who's locked into a performance. So how much of that part of performance is lost through the technology, and is there any way to compensate for it?
Well, interesting question, because we use live musicians on stage. And so there is that spontaneity that exists with those musicians.
Between themselves, but not with a hologram.
Between themselves, right. That's right. But, you know, I can easily argue that if you go see, I don't know who it is, or I do know who it is, but I won't say, there are many artists that do exactly the same show every single time. So this is no different than that.
Marty Tudor is the CEO of Bass Hologram Productions. Marty, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Bass Hologram's Callison Concert will be at USC's Bovard Auditorium this Saturday, April 13th. Coming up on The Frame, an experimental production of King Lear that keeps the king in the wings.
KPCC podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures, presenting Dogman, a sly crime thriller from the award-winning director of Gomorra, winner of the Best Actor Award at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival and the European Film Awards. Dogman tells a story of vengeance where only the strong will survive. Official selection of the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals and the winner of 9 Italian Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, and Actor. Opens Friday, April 12th in New York and Los Angeles.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. One way to gear up for this Sunday's return of HBO's Game of Thrones is to revisit another classic bloody battle over a kingdom, a castle, and a country. This week, the Source Material Company is staging King Lear, the American premiere of its experimental production. As The Frame contributor Marcos Najera tells us, these artists decided it was better to cut the king out of this version entirely.
In Shakespeare's King Lear, the aging monarch of Britain is tired. And he wants to step down from his throne and divide up his riches and responsibilities. So he decides to test his children to see which of the three is most worthy of his wealth. And with that, the king challenges his daughters to prove who loves him the most. Well, you probably know where it goes from there. The eldest daughters flatter their father and get everything, while the youngest, Cordelia, angers him. So King Lear banishes her from the court. Eventually, the king goes crazy and loses everything. And in the end, Cordelia is killed.
No, please. I'm only like in half costume. Come on.
The Source Material Theater Company adds a twist in Shakespeare's classic tragedy.
Come, let's await prison. We two alone will sing like birds in the cage.
In this production, the king isn't seen on stage.
When thou dost ask my blessing, I'll kneel down and beg of thee forgiveness.
Here's company founder Samantha Shea.
I will say, you know, it's really funny being in American theater again because there's a lot more rules.
Shea is an American theater artist who trained at CalArts, but has been working overseas for the past several years. This is her first production back in the States since mounting a show for the 2014 Hollywood Fringe Festival.
It's like, you can't touch that cable or something like that. I'm like, what? What is that? You know, it's like in Poland, I could have candles and, you know, like things flying through the air and no one cared. And now it's like, you can't touch that plastic. That's illegal. I'm like, okay.
Shea grew up in what she calls a magical farming village in Massachusetts, not far from Boston. She would travel into Cambridge to see shows at the American Repertory Theater. She still remembers seeing its production of Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit, in which three actors had to balance a moving stage all night using nothing but their bodies.
It was this visual composition, like energetic force running the entire play. It was just masterful. I was only 16 when I saw it, and I think that showed me an example of how doing something sort of unconventional can completely elevate a text.
And even though she loved existential French masterpieces just as much as any teenager, American classics captured her attention too.
High on a hill was a lonely goat, herd lay, herd lay, herd lay.
I always wanted to do theater and be an actress from a very young age. I was very into, you know, The Sound of Music and Julie Andrews. And Audrey Hepburn and old movies more than like the animated ones, and I would act them out.
I don't want my hair cut. I don't want my eyebrows up or down. I want them right where they are.
I would act out to all the movies in my living room, full on costumes, and then if anyone walked in, I'd be like, you have to leave right now.
It's wonderful.
It was just so personal for me. I wasn't ready to share it with other people, I guess. My mom would be at the door, I'd be like, you have to go.
Shea's childhood love for details, especially music and sound, now inspire her to create art that asks audience members to listen as much as watch.
And hear poor rogues talk of court news, who loses and who wins, who's in things.
I just had an idea, Nini.
As if we were
Let's
God's
slowly
spies.
Switch places as she goes down.
Her King Lear production is a prime example of an audio-rich experience where the script is more often soundtrack than spoken text. It's laced with music and movement, which often replace those celebrated lines and scenes that you might remember studying in high school or college.
Even though we're not seeing the scenes, we're not hearing certain lines that are super famous, you know, or certain moments and some characters we don't meet, every single aspect of this performance comes from the text.
Shay is quick to point out her excitement to play with structure, blending lines and combining characters from Shakespeare's script. The biggest surprise here is that the figurehead in the story, King Lear himself, is all but forgotten.
In Shakespeare, there's a lot of mothers who are absent. The mother is always missing. So I thought, what if the mother was there? And then Dita, I just had this feeling like, oh, that's who Dita is.
Unhappy that I am.
And it was really funny because I hired her, and then she called me and she was like, I'm pregnant.
I cannot heave my heart into my mouth.
These are questions that I ask myself every day.
That's actress Dita Berkley, who plays the mother, a newly imagined character conjured up just for this show.
In terms of parenthood, but also in terms of what kind of human beings are running this world and what choices we make and how we become who we become.
As we talk, Samantha Shay brings in Berkley's baby, a cute newborn named Namkai.
Hello. Yes.
And while his real mom is busy playing a mother on stage, the other actors form sort of a tribe of surrogate mothers for Dita Berkley to help care for the child.
Of course, it's a little bit difficult for me sometimes, too. I feel slight schizophrenia.
But the baby's presence, she says, is a reminder that the characters in this play must constantly confront questions about caring for other people, from the very old to the very young. For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
The Source Material Company's production of King Lear is at the Bootleg Theater in L.A. from Thursday through Sunday. And that's it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.